This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 66th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is Two Intriguing Minds in Conversation. I'm joined by both David Birch and Fred Matzer for a special edition episode focused on what you might call philosophizing on how one might or should see the world and live one's life. David Birch is the author of Pandora's book, 401 Philosophical Questions to Help You Lose Your Mind with Answers. The publisher is IFF Books, an imprint of John Hunt Publishing. And Fred Matzer is the author of Beyond Us, A Humanitarian's Perspective on Our Values, Beliefs, and Way of Life. The publisher is likewise IFF Books. David Birch teaches philosophy and religious studies at Highgate School in London and also works with the Philosophy Foundation. Fred Matzer is the founder and chairman of the Fred Foundation and a leading Dutch humanitarian, as well as the founder or co-founder of a wide range of other foundations. Welcome to the show, David and Fred.
Hello, Dan.
Thank you so much.
Very much looking forward to it. So briefly, let's start with you, David. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of your book? It's intriguing. And how did you get to these 401 questions that you chose?
Well, it started off with questions I'd written for students. They were sort of bored with the set topics that we were doing as part of public examinations. And I wanted something to stimulate them more and to provoke them more. So I started writing these questions, and I wrote about a dozen of them. And they're sort of philosophical questions with yes or no answers. And they just kept asking for more, and their appetite was insatiable, to the point where I got to 401, although there were more, I had to cut down. But I wanted to just to sort of share that experience that they'd had through the questions and through discovering problems that they found particularly fascinating and important to them with other people. And so it's sort of an introduction to philosophy, but which acts not to sort of guide you through the core topics, not to be a sort of 101 lecture series, but to plunge you into the kind of the upper ear of philosophical confusion and experience for yourself the perplexities of philosophical thought. And so the way I sort of conceive of it is introductory books tend to be sort of front doors into philosophy. They sort of welcome you in. I'm not sure philosophy quite works like that. I think it's more a subject you enter through trapdoors. The floor opens up beneath you and you suddenly find yourself confronted with philosophical questions that you find particularly bewildering and baffling and exciting. And so that was really the aim of the book. And then the answers are drawn from a variety of sources, such as writers as well as philosophers, because I just simply was almost approaching it as a sort of headness, wanting to find those texts that would be the most stimulating and interesting to use, not necessarily the ones that are that would sort of be the standard texts for those questions.
Yeah, no, they were not the standard texts. I mean, after all, the questions like, is perfume art? Is poetry flammable? I enjoyed those very much. I'm glad the students pushed you along in doing this. And then Fred, in your case, what was the inspiration for the book and what's it about?
Yeah, my inspiration was that I more and more came to see not only being a part of society and a world in which we live with society, with our environment and the animals, I came more and more in a position that I could look at it. And a big boost in that respect was a kind of transcendental experience, which I had many years ago, which really brought me in a level of consciousness that was so informing and more than pleasant that I got out of that experience with many questions. And so I started to look from a distance and see how we behave and take a different perspective on our human behavior. And doing that, it helps me also to change my own behavior for the better.
Yeah, no, I found it interesting because I approached both of these initially as books that were about philosophy, but in David's case, I discovered all these wonderful literary allusions. And in Fred, in your case, I said, well, you know, I think of philosophy in terms of one's thoughts, but you're very focused on physical sensations, one's emotions, and indeed how one actually behaves, including within a community structure. So there's a broad purview to this book that goes far beyond what might be traditionally thought of as philosophy. I also have to say, in your case, Fred, there's some amazing endorsements for this book. I mean, it's not very often that I will see endorsements that range from Gorbachev to Jane Goodall. That's quite a range and quite a compliment to you. David, in your case, let's go back to something that's pretty foundational. Right in the introduction, you say, you raise the question, why does philosophy exist? So I want to give you a chance to answer that seminal question.
I think my answer is entirely unsatisfactory.
But quite all right, go ahead.
I sort of posit a drive, sort of the cognitive equivalent to the libido, something that just impels us to question and to seek perplexity and bewildering sort of problems. And it was just, I was really just sort of reifying the experience of, I think, the appetite, the philosophical appetite. Is there actually such a drive? I called it the epinoa. I don't know. I mean, it was more just a way to sort of, it's more like a homunculus, really, a sort of a character, the internal philosopher. And so I don't know why philosophy exists.
But that's, I mean, okay. I thought you had an answer in part because you talked about our insatiable curiosity that we probe, we stretch, we wonder. We know we don't actually have the answers, including to the question I just gave you.
Yes.
And that's actually okay because that's part of the predicament and part of the fun in exploring it. Am I putting words in your mouth, or is that a fair enough distillation of what I thought I read in your introduction?
No, yeah, that's fair. But that insatiable curiosity, I'm not sure. I don't have an explanation for that. I mean, I suppose as animals, and I suppose Fred might have something to say about this, as animals seemingly that don't have our own natural habitats as such, who are able to go beyond particular habitats, maybe as a sort of to accompany that, we were given the sort of cognitive ability to also wander beyond conceptual familiarity in our conceptual habitats. So there might be a correlation there. But I mean, I'm just wildly speculating.
That's quite all right. I mean, I thought that was one of the points of affinity, because very early in your book, Fred, in your essay called Paths, you talked about kind of a polarity or duality between being driven by security and convenience as opposed to curiosity and wonderment. And you certainly come down on the latter end of those two choices. What do you want to say about why philosophy exists and the role of curiosity?
Yeah, well, I think philosophy exists in consciousness, and it's a language, a way we organize information and we can interact with one another, amongst others, around the theme path. And philosophy, in a way, is a path. What I want to say with that is, say, thousands and thousands of years ago, there were no paths. People just walked in nature, used their intuition to inform them where to go, where to find food. And gradually, people developed paths. And fast forward, we have paths that make us basically restrict our choices. Although through IT, we have millions of choices to make, we are prohibited from making choices beyond those paths where there are billions of other forms of choices. So I wanted to get our attention to the fact that it looks like we have infinite possibilities with technology, but basically, when you look at it differently, it pre-programs us in, it's like multiple choice on a big scale. Well, before, we didn't have that limitation. That's one way to look at path. If you can see it as an advantage or disadvantage, I don't know. I mean, sparrows, birds, or many of animals don't have these restrictions in choices. They can just go their own way. So in that way, are we that smart? I'm not sure. We have a high level of being individual in a way that restricts us, and it discerns. And from animals that have consciousness-wise a less restricted consciousness, because they are part of often group consciousness and much more in touch with signals in nature than we are. We created our own restrictions in that respect.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think there are no answers very often. I think Gertrude Stein said that, in fact, the answer is that there are no answers, but the ready-made prefabricated answer might be the very worst of all answers. The way I'm going to frame this going forward now is there are indeed these 401 questions that were in David's book, prompted in part by the students' curiosity and desire for more of these. I've chosen a few. I've looked for correlations that I think lend them back to some of the things that Fred has written about as well. And I'm just going to go after a few of these, and that might be the framework for how we discuss things, and it may not prove to be. Who knows? We'll take whatever path makes sense here. Let's do it that way. But let's at least begin to assume we have some semblance of a path. So I'm going to go really early in the book. It's question number 7, David. It was, are you a stranger to yourself? And as I read what followed in the answer, I went back to my literature days as a PhD student in English and would often talk about the unreliable narrator of the novel. Are we all unreliable narrators in life? Are we indeed strangers to yourself? What did you say in the book, and what do you think yourself personally?
Just before I answer that, I just wanted to return to something Fred said, because it just struck me as an interesting parallel. Fred was talking about paths, which is a really interesting concept, because Socrates, in his sort of process of questioning people, he wanted to induce the state of aporia, which etymologically means without a path. And so, you know, going back to Socrates, his aim there was to rid people of these paths. So this concept of a path seems particularly rich. In terms of that question, are you a stranger to yourself? I mean, I suppose the fact that I find it difficult to know the answer suggests I am. The answer I look at, and I sometimes forget because there are so many. Was it Samuel Butler?
Joseph Butler, yes.
Joseph Butler, sorry. His view was that our lack of self-awareness is the root of our sort of moral failings. It's because we don't know ourselves that we're capable of sort of committing acts of great moral turpitude. But I might be inclined to flip that on its head and say that it's excessive self-knowledge that could actually be the problem often. Being too committed to ideas about who we are or what we need, particularly in the case of, say, greed. The greedy person, in a way, is not a stranger to themselves because they know precisely what they want. And that causes them to act in violent and rapacious ways. And so maybe sort of divesting ourselves of self-knowledge is actually would be morally beneficial, perhaps.
Well, I don't want to make it too contemporary, but since I've read the book and prepared the question, we've had the resignation of the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, who in his faux apology and taking quote-unquote full responsibility for what took place with his transgressions with 11 women did not, in fact, seem to take full responsibility, as pretty much everybody noted. He seemed to be very much a stranger to himself, intentionally or not. Mm. Fred, in your case, I thought a correlation to this was you were talking about knowledge, including obviously self-knowledge. And you know, an interesting quote, you say, "It is as if God were trying to call us, but the telephone line were always busy." What's your viewpoint and the degree to which we understand ourselves and indeed actually have knowledge as opposed to what you called self-generated personal dramas?
Yeah, we are in a way an expression of information that what expresses itself in form, and we can communicate information through the mind and through our feelings. And but if we help to put our mind to a rest, mind in a way is also an alternative to what we earlier discussed as the path, then we can go into the field of our feelings and heart. That means we can just graze the meadows and we can go through the forest without the path. And in that case, our consciousness can be informed from beyond. Instead of thinking, we allow ourselves to be thought. Instead of feeling, we allow ourselves to be felt. It means to letting go of control and still be alert and allow with what is given as information through our intuition, feeling, and heart to go our way.
Yeah, no, that's very much how I took it, that you were trying to not overly privilege, I guess I'd say, the thought faculties and allow for that we sense, we feel, and we think. And all three have a role, and it is sometimes the first two, the sensing and feeling, that gets undermined or ignored or kind of put down, as it were.
No, and indeed, I think the big problem is we have put the thinking capacity on a pedestal. And if we think without allowing our thoughts to go through the heart, the decisions that we take may be like unguided missiles that hit and can create enormous chaos, like climate change. Because what we forget, the feminine side in all of us, the receiving side of feeling, we don't use. The intuition, we don't take serious. We compete, we don't cooperate. I would say if we can make the move from competition to cooperation and comparing with care in order to share with care in an inclusive system, then we would create and change our society in a more functional and loving way.
Fair enough. Moving on, but in a related way, I'm hoping another thing you bring up, David, in the book, it's question 39, and I'm not trying to make you grab your book and quickly peruse through the what was written on it. But if you can speak from instinct or however you want to approach it. But the question number 39 is, do you have an identity? And I'm interested in this, including in the context of Fred's book, because that identity, to the extent it is woven around oneself and the degree to which one understands oneself, but also bringing in other people in your life, whether it's an intimate circle or community and society and even the planet itself. What's your sense of how we might approach that question, which is so foundational? Do you have an identity? What might you offer to us there?
Well, it's interesting that you use the word circle, because I think for that one, I use Emerson as the answer.
You do?
From his essay Circles. And the way he seems to conceive of identity is that it's a limitation, or at least our identity should be fashioned through a sort of process of constantly evolving into greater circles, a process of becoming. So I mean, it's very much connected to the previous question about self-knowledge. And you know, Dan, you allude to the potential problems of people sort of abdicating their sort of claims to self-knowledge, because it could lead to sort of thereby abdicating their responsibility for their actions. And so there are possibly dangers, but I'm more sympathetic to the sort of the Emersonian perspective of that our identity should be something in which we're constantly seeking to sort of shed. And again, that self-knowledge can be a sort of terrible limitation on our capacity to think. And maybe it's similar to what Fred was saying, that it's better to embrace a sort of a state of openness, and that notions of identity can foreclose that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, no, that's one of the things I enjoyed in my readings of Emerson. He made me think very much of a contemporary of his, Walt Whitman, who in one of his poems said, "Do I contradict myself? Very well, I contradict myself. I am full of multitudes." I loved how Emerson was always seeking to be becoming, and allow that there was contradictions in his thoughts, because it was all a matter of the exploration.
But I wonder if that's something that we'll sort of delight in if a poet says it, but if a politician had said the same thing, how would we react?
That's true. Well, if you have a long enough career, like our current president, Mr. Biden, I think there's going to be contradictions. And yes, we can go after them pretty hard. With the standards of different eras, it certainly does happen. Yes,
but would we permit the politician, you know, that the poet's way out?
Or do we hold them to different standards? Well, the politician holds power, presumably. The poets rarely do. And I speak as a former poet, and I can assure you I had no power whatsoever as a poet. So I think the question comes, do the standards and the beliefs bring harm to others? And maybe the politician's in more of a position to bring that harm, unfortunately, as well as benefits, perhaps. And that could be why the standard applies. But should some allowances be made? I think they could be. Depends on the degree of harm, perhaps. Fred, your thoughts on where we're at right now. I was thinking about community consciousness in part, because you have a lot of critiques of what I would say is almost implicitly about American individualism, because you're concerned that they, you know, it's not just about self-preservation, but also paying attention to the community.
Yeah, you know, there are wonderful examples of how we can cooperate. I earlier mentioned this already. Take an orchestra. People have joy in playing music. Those instruments were made by people that were able to make those instruments and to tune them. And then the musicians, they play together. And instead of competing with one another to exclude them, no, they allow one another to play a solo and support the other in playing the solo. So what it teaches me is that, yes, we can cooperate together, we can do things together, but we can allow others to shine too. And when they're shining, we're not jealous of them. No, we can support them. And if we would use that metaphor for organizing our society, it would work much better. The basic problem is that in our whole human culture, we have put the male function on a pedestal at the cost of the feminine, of the female function. And so everything that the mind produces is valued, and intuition we don't take serious. And so the male part comes with individualism and competition and cooperation and togetherness that is a representation of the female principle. So if women can help us to more use our female side, and when we can, as men, remind women to not go and make the same mistakes as we do, we could do things together much better.
Okay, well, that brings me nicely to the next topic I want to talk about, which is indeed the role of emotions. And I'll stay with you, Fred, for a moment, because maybe you want to elaborate on what you just said, because this comes up in your essay on competition as opposed to cooperation, which is what an orchestra needs. And you have the statement, all we ultimately have are our own feelings. And where I want to take this in a moment is one of the questions you raise, David, is, can emotions lie? And another question was, is everything we do motivated by desire? And the degree to which we're talking about reason versus emotion and desire would be intriguing to me. But let's stay with you, Fred, for a moment. What more would you like to say about the importance of that statement? Ultimately, all we have are our own inner feelings. That seems like really central to your essays.
Yeah. The first thing I wanted to reiterate, allow yourself to listen to your feelings. And do know when your feelings are burdened with emotions. Emotions are different from feelings. Feelings in itself are basically neutral. It's the vibration, the pure vibration that we can experience when we don't have opinions. So then we can be part of a total consciousness. But emotions are very popular in a way. They are forms of fear that makes the instrument of feeling play false. When you play the violin on the string, the sound it produces has the freedom to go through the body of the violin. And an emotion in that way of expressing it is like a block of chewing gum on that body of the violin. So if we would bring our attention the chewing gum, our love, inside, it will melt and we can come back in feel into the real feelings. Am I a little bit clear to express this?
I admit to being a little bit lost in that. I think psychologists normally use the word feelings for what we've gotten to on a conscious state of reflection, and emotions when it's on a more intuitive level. But however the terminology gets used, there can be a distinction between the two terms. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a different way of expressing it. Sorry, yeah, then I understand that it can be confusing.
Oh, no, that's quite right. This is an exploration as opposed to pat answers, so that's fine. David, as you've been listening to this and thinking about the two questions from your book that I raised, what might you want to say about the role of emotions and whether they lie and how much we are motivated by desire in terms of our actions in life as opposed to reason?
Well, in terms of emotions lying, William James had the thought that our emotions are, many of our emotions are actually reactions to physiological states. So that it's not that we say experience fear emotionally and then our body reacts and our heart rate increases. It's that the fear is a reaction to what the body is doing. Which then, if James is right about that, then the question then becomes whether the body can lie. And I think it's certainly the case that it could be it could be deceptive if we think of the way that the body is going to be reacting to the environment that it's in. And so the environment can cause our bodies to react in ways that lead to emotions that actually maybe aren't are going to sort of distort our self-understanding. So, for instance, an exam hall, maybe. If you go into an exam hall and it leads to a sense of nervousness, and that might lead you to believe that, wow, you think this is really important or this is really what you want. But that might not be the case at all. But the environment has impressed itself upon you in such a way that can distort the way you feel and then distort your understanding of what you really want. I think it reminds me of something Gilles Deleuze said, I think in Anti-Oedipus, that the incest taboo doesn't exist because it's actually what we want. It's the taboo is created to make us believe it's what we want. And so the taboo is there to manufacture a sort of sense of desire which isn't actually true. And in terms of that question of do we always follow our desires, I think I'd think of that in normative terms and think we don't, and maybe think that we ought to. I mean, Jeremy Bentham, the utilitarian, thought that we are always desirous of pleasure. We're always pursuing pleasure, which is a sort of almost a paradoxical state, because it's sort of always desiring satisfaction, which is an end to desire. So desire is sort of seeking its own annihilation. But I think it would be an interesting experiment to sort of to live in such a way that the things that we're perpetually desiring are desire itself. And I think that would be an interesting project.
Well, I do have a couple of foundational beliefs in this realm. One is, and I really intrigued with the idea, can the body lie to itself, and how much is the presentation, the stimuli and the environment and the situation something that could lead to us, the body unwittingly lying to itself, if nothing else. I guess one thing I go to is a statement someone once made that, the two things we most want in life is to feel good about ourselves and to attract others, and it comes back to survival. And that with emotions, fear is so foundational because, after all, it is about the survival of the species and the reproduction of the species. And if you're not around, you're not going to reproduce. And that seems to me, solid enough as a starting point here. Often, I have to ask a question. I wasn't going to go there necessarily, but since we're talking about desire, I just can't resist one of the questions in your book, David. It's number 192. And I've never in my 65 podcasts to date gone near the subject of sex. But here you have 192 is it possible to have dignified sex? I imagine the listeners could be interested in the answer.
Well, some of the questions are sort of leading in a way, because Saint Augustine had the view that it is the reason why we do it in private is because it's intrinsically shameful. So he was connecting the fact that it's there's a lack of dignity, or dignity etymologically is worthiness. There's a lack of worthiness about it to it being shameful. I don't think his argument is convincing, but I do think that it's interesting because it's a realm of social life. Essentially, it is a social activity in which, because it's private, there aren't norms and codes of etiquette as to how to do it. So it's very improvised in a lot of ways. It's not something which we can really do impolitely or politely. Those sort of concepts don't apply to it. And so I don't think the concept of dignity applies to it. And I think that why I think that's interesting is something that's so important to us is an experience in which there is no way to do it in a dignified manner, or perhaps there is, but we haven't invented the codes to do so. And that maybe that's for the best. And therefore it might lead us to radically revise our notion of the importance of dignity. Because the question inside the question, I suppose, is how important is dignity?
Yes.
And I'm skeptical about it.
And Fred, I want to bring you in on this. I mean, the realm of the senses, of dignity, pleasure, connection, community, I'm sure you have a vantage point on this.
Yeah, well, I think sex and tennis have, in the original meaning, a lot in common. Way back, tennis was developed to play together. So I play the ball to you, for example, David, in such a way that you can stretch and return the ball. So in such a way that we can do the continuum, which, by the way, is the basis of the whole universe, plus and minus. So we help one another to stretch and be in touch. With making love, it is the same. We are together. There is no dignity. There's no non-dignity. It's just a creative act like tennis is. We play together, and new expressions of life can come from it. So if we start to sit on the sideline as a journalist and look at sex, we may have thousands of opinions. You know, so some people like to do it private, of most of them. Some people don't care if it's private or public, you know. It's there who decides on what is good or what is non-good. It's indeed one day somebody important shame. And with shame, the whole thing started to be a little bit different, I think. Why would sex be shameless? Are we all products running around here as a product of some act of shame? We are 7 billion people, all the animals, all forms of creation. Is nature shaming herself for itself, for the creative act?
Yeah, Augustine, he thought that the reason why it's shameful is because it involves a lack of control. So
but there we go, and that's the original subject. If we can allow ourselves to be thought and to be felt, which means let go of control but still be present, which is something different, then life would change. We don't need to lose ourselves when we are not in control. We can be fully aware even.
Well, and very interesting, David, in your book at one point, I don't remember which question it is, but the Marquis de Sade enters the book. And his version of sex involved, interestingly, both a great deal of him wanting to exercise control and a great deal of wanting to throw off religion and commit heresies, which was trying to evade control. That's how I took it.
Yeah, and he was, in the extract I use, he's trying to free sex from the idea of it being unnatural, that all desires, but the implication he has is that the only unnatural desire is the desire to end desire. Beyond that, all desires are natural. Now, I don't know whether that's a particularly interesting insight or if that just ultimately means that the concept of what is natural and what is unnatural doesn't apply and we can't get any sort of use out of it.
Okay. I will go on to another question, if you don't mind, Jerry. We only have a few minutes, and I wanted to take it a little bit more in a personal direction. I think I have a fairly good sense, especially from your essays, David, of what your orientation, moral underpinnings are. David, you're posing the questions, and there are answers from others, but I'm looking for your own voice as well, and I'm intrigued by what you might say. One of the questions, 108, was, which would you most like to excel in? And the options given in 108, if I remember correctly, were strength, intelligence, kindness, or beauty. Forced to choose, David, in your case, I'd be curious what your answer might be.
The thing is, these questions, they can be quite revealing, and you know, so I feel I ought to say kindness, but I think in truth my answer would be intelligence.
And anything you want to elaborate on that?
So, I mean, there's a way of conceiving of intelligence. I think we've been alluding to this throughout, which is that of possessing the answers and of being able to, say, attain a sort of sense of superiority over others because you possess these answers and you possess the knowledge. But I would see intelligence as really being the ability to identify problems and to use problems in ways to extend and excite your own thoughts. So as I conceive it of it, that an intelligent life would be an exciting life. Does that make sense?
No, I think that's a fair answer. When you mentioned that the answer one perhaps should choose is kindness, I have a new book coming out shortly called Blah, 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 A Snarky Guide to Office Lingo. And one of the contributions was about empathy. And the person said, doing an act of kindness, but hoping secretly that it gets recorded and gets broadcast on social media, which is revealing of the state of society today. But no, I think intelligence, as you're defining it, is often mapped to the character trait of openness to experience.
Right.
As well as openness to inquiry itself. Fred, sure, go ahead.
Can we all put our cards on the table now that I've done so?
I admit, as I get older, I actually might choose beauty. I used to put up with really shabby apartments as I moved from one place to another. And at some point in my late 30s, I said, I can't stand this anymore. I want to be out in nature. And when I'm back home, I want it to look nicer than it's been in the past. And if I'm poor for it, so be it. Because I think I can expand and term the notion of beauty to mean the beauty of one's conduct with others, the not being caught up in adversarial emotions like envy and so forth. I remember my father saying to me at one point, you know, there's no easier way to drive yourself crazy than spend your time comparing yourself to others.
Yeah.
So that's how I take beauty. But yeah, let's put the cards on the table. Fred, which would you choose and why?
Well, you know, first of all, when you mentioned it, I thought from the inside, do I experience beauty and to what extent? Why would I compare? Perhaps more beautiful than yesterday? Would I experience my own intelligence without comparing it to others? What would it feel to just feel intelligent? What is it? Is it intelligent to experience beauty? Is it beautiful to experience intelligence? The same with kindness. We can all reverse it. Do we want to experience these qualities through others so that it reflects on us how they judge us as being beautiful, intelligent, or kind. And then I would prefer to go for the mix because I cannot see one from the other.
Yeah, no, I suspect that's ultimately the answer. So, well, we put our cards on the table. I'm not sure whether they're the ace of spades or the four of clubs, but hopefully we put a few cards on the table here. Fred, was there something more you wanted to say before I wrap up here?
One little thing. I think David said something about intelligence is the capacity to solve problems. Is that not too narrow a definition? Because if you see wholeness, then maybe all problems will dissolve. Do we need to intervene into a problem, what we may see as a problem? It's just a question. I mean, I don't think we need to narrow it down to solving problems. It is society looks at it as intelligent people in that way, but I'm not sure.
And before I come to the close, David, do you want to have a last word there?
Sure. Yeah, I don't think I said solving problems. I think it's that sort of terminating them. I think it's actually the way I understand it is being able to unearth, dwell in and utilize problems to extend the conceptual framework with which we use to understand the world. So I wouldn't want it to be a matter of silencing the problems at all.
Fair enough. I've been in the business world where officially there are no problems. There are only challenges and solutions, which led me knew right away that I was not in a space that I was going to feel comfortable in, because obviously there are problems in the world. Yeah. I want to thank you both so much, David and Fred, for being my guests here today. This has been episode number 66, Two Intriguing Minds in Conversation. My guest, David Birch, he is the author of Pandora's book, 401 Philosophical Questions to Help You Lose Your Mind with Answers. And Fred Matzer is the author of Beyond Us, A Humanitarian's Perspective on Our Values, Beliefs, and Ways of Life. If you've enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. You can check out other episodes by visiting my company's website at the obligatory 3 W's and sensorylogic.com. Or you can go to the New Books Network, type in the show's name, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, and find the other episodes there. Finally, I'd like to conclude every episode with an epigram, but I've had two guests today, and I can't resist having two different epigrams that I'm going to close with. The first comes from William Shakespeare, "Ripeness is all," and the second from one of my personal favorites, Henry David Thoreau, who said, "Our winged thoughts are turned to poultry." Until next time, be kind and stay safe.